Open your Bibles, if you will, to Joshua chapter 1. As I was thinking about today's lesson, it looked pretty academic to me. And I really don't want any part of this study this year to have that sense. And it occurred to me that it's only academic if we don't apply it to everyday life. So I want to start today's lesson making that this section, the conquest and settlement of Canaan, be some sort of an application, and then at the end the lesson with an application as well, because there is so much in the book of Joshua that is powerful for today, for me, for you. You know, the story of Joshua is Moses has been the leader of Israel for 40 plus years. He's been an amazing leader. He's brought them to the edge, if you will, of the promised land. He and his brother Aaron, as the spiritual high priest, has set some standards. They've gotten a sense of what it's like to be a sort of theocracy where there's moral laws and social laws and certainly the laws associated with all of their feast days and festivals. All that's been done, and along comes the moment to come on into the promised land and now get what God has for them. And at that moment, Aaron dies off and Moses dies off, and the young leader Joshua is in charge. And he I don't know exactly how old he is. I'm going to make some guesses that he's around 60, and in that time frame, he's a pretty young leader. He's kind of freaked out. He's looking at, "You want us to do what, God?" kind of thing. Well, you're not personally conquering foreign lands that I know of. Maybe some of you are doing that on the side. But you are facing issues. And your issues might be family or marriage. Your issues might be financial or health. Your issues might be yet another leak in your kitchen again. You may have other issues. And at moments in life, no matter how much you know the good stuff that God is doing in your life, it's frustrating, it's fear-evoking, it's, now what do we do? And to start the book of Joshua for us personally is the same place where really God began to work with Joshua in verse number 7. Actually, I want to back up to, let's say verse number 3. I'm going to give you every place where you set your foot, as I promised Moses. Your territory is going to extend from the desert to Lebanon, from the great river, the Euphrates, all the Hittite country to the Mediterranean Sea in the west. I got great plans for you, Joshua. No one will be able to stand against you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will never leave you or forsake you. Be strong and courageous, because you will lead these people to inherit the land I spoke to their ancestors to give them. Be strong and very courageous. Be careful to obey all the law my servant Moses gave you. Don't turn from it to the right or to the left, that you may be successful wherever you go. Keep this book of the law always on your lips. Meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do everything written in it. And that's a big "and then," you will be prosperous and successful. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. Now, I don't know who you're leading today. Probably people about this big, somewhere in that range. You're not leading 6 million Jews into the promised land. You got ones or twos or threes of this kind. But you are leading nonetheless. And the giants that they were going to face and the issues they were going to face as they went in to conquer the promised land are not the same kinds of giants and same kinds of difficulties. But I'm telling you right now that if you came to class this morning and there's a heaviness on your heart for whatever reason, this installation of Joshua as a leader is a great passage to use like salve on your soul. So with that in mind, let's start the conquest and settlement of Canaan. It took them about 24 months to wander around from Egypt to Kadesh Barnea. And we looked at, at several of the map ideas to try to get in our mind what it looked like when we're approaching Kadesh Barnea. They wandered around the Sinai Peninsula. We've already talked about that. It's about 24 months. And they get to Kadesh Barnea. Turn to Numbers 14 just to remind yourself what happened when they got there. They're going to send in the spies. Remember the story. The people go in. They come back. They do a lot of exploring. And they give a report. And their report essentially is there's giants in the land. There's big guys and they're going to get us. And there are big guys. There's no doubt about it. The thing that's really important is that Caleb and Joshua are the two descending votes. Out of the 12 spies, verse 30 of chapter 13 of Numbers, I think I said 14. Then Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, "We should go up and we should take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "Hey, we can't attack these people. They're stronger than we are." They spread out among the Israelites a bad report about the land they had explored. You know what? A little parenthetical comment here. This bad report thing, it was bad then, and it's bad now. We were just having a board meeting upstairs, and we were chuckling a little bit about what I call parking lot chatter. Most of the time, parking lot chatter is a bad report. It's not a positive thing. Sometimes it is, but often it isn't. Sometimes after a Sunday school lesson, the group that gathers outside the door and begins to criticize or critique the guy who just left or just did the lesson, or pastor, you know, you have roasted pastor as you go out to eat that afternoon, you know, "I didn't like the way he did. You like the way the music was really, I don't know, that guy, I really prefer that other song later." That's called a bad report. Yeah, we're still doing that now. It ain't good. Anyway, the land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. That's an overstatement. We saw the Nephilim there, the descendants of Anak that came from the Nephilim. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes. We looked the same to them. They're going to eat us. Yeah, okay. Joshua and Caleb said, you know, a fact's a fact. There were some tall dudes in there. Fact's a fact. Your finances might be upside down. Fact's a fact. The doctor gave a poor report on health. A fact's a fact. Your business isn't doing what it should be. A fact's a fact. You've got another leak in your kitchen. A fact's a fact. All them rest of them. My kid's not the superstar that we always wanted him to be. There are facts in life. But there's always two ways to look at those facts. And Joshua and Caleb did the, yeah, okay, fact's a fact, but let's go do what God told us. And God reminds him when he gets to Joshua chapter 1, of his being with them. Now, there were a couple of stories. And remember, in our first lesson, I showed you a picture of a closet. And the idea was to take a lot of the stories that you've heard over your whole lifetime and put them somewhere in the closet. So three or two right here, I guess. Two stories I want to make sure you have a place in your closet. The first one is Moses' big mistake. I don't have time today to unfold this whole thing, but I want you to write next to Roman numeral 1c, two other verses, Exodus 15 and Exodus 17. There are three times when Moses is confronted with getting water out of the ground. Three times. In the first instance in Exodus 15, God tells him to throw a stick in. He throws a stick in and the water turns sweet. You remember that? The waters of Marah. In Exodus 17, a God tells him to smack the rock and water is going to come out. And here we are in Numbers 20. Moses says to himself, "Hey, I got this water thing down. You're supposed to smack it. So I'm going to explain to everybody while I smack it that I'm God's man. Watch me get water out of the rock. Happened last time. Here we go." And what does he do? Smacks the rock. But what did God tell him to do? Speak to the rock. Big lesson here, big lesson for all of our lives. God is not in the repeat business. Just about the time you think you have him down, he's got another plan. He's got a new way of working. He's the God of miracles. He's the God of my way, not your way. About the time you got the, "Oh yeah, I got this down," we throw the stick in. "Oh no, we don't throw it in, I smack it." No, you speak to it. Each individual circumstance requiring a different response. Moses' mistake here is that he didn't listen to the instruction of God. And it cost him big time. What did it cost him? Somebody tell me.
He didn't get to go to the promised land.
Didn't get to go in the promised land. Two scores right there. Pete and repeat right there. He didn't get to go in the promised land. That's exactly correct. What a terrible situation that is. He wasn't allowed to lead them in. So that's where that story goes. The next one is in Numbers 22. And this is the story of Balaam and the donkey. My Balaam and the donkey. Hold on. There's my Balaam and the donkey. This is a great Sunday school lesson. Most of you can tell me the basic story. A guy's riding a donkey, and he wants the donkey to go, and the donkey stops, and he starts smacking the donkey, and he's mad at the donkey because the donkey won't go where he wants him to go, and he smacks him again, and pretty soon the donkey talks to him. That's what we know. That's the Sunday school version. Okay, what's happening here? What's happening here is a guy by the name of Balak saw that Israel was marching on their way up into coming to the promised land, and he's freaking out. He's a leader. He's going, oh my goodness, here they come. They've wiped out that other group. They're going to come wipe out us. I need someone, a prophet, a seer, S-E-E-R, to come and lay down a curse on Israel. And I've heard there's this guy named Balaam, and if we go get Balaam, Balaam will come and lay down a curse against Israel as they march up against our nation. And so Balak sends some men to go find Balaam and bring Balaam to him so that he can pronounce a curse on Israel. It is a fascinating story. You ought to read it from Numbers 22 through, I guess, chapter 24. And in the middle of that, God uses the donkey to call to Balaam's attention that he's being a bit of a donkey himself. A little humor there. That's where the talking donkey story comes in. Now, they wander around and at about 120 years of age, Moses actually dies. Once he dies, they have got to now come in under the leadership of Joshua and subdue the land. Now, they came up, and this particular map will give you a sense of it. They came up. Kadesh Barnea is down here. They went wandering around for the 40 years. They come up. They tried to go down through the what they call the King's Highway, and they were not allowed. And so they had to go around Moab and down through this section to get to the top part of the Dead Sea so they can come in. Remember, Jerusalem is right about here. So they're going to come into the Promised Land right here from having wandered around the Sinai Peninsula. They're passing through Moab, coming around, going over the top of the Dead Sea, and coming into here. Now, what did God promise them? What did he want them to do? What was the scope of their assignment? Turn to Numbers 33. Good place to get that sense. Numbers 33. It's kind of towards the end of the story, but I want to start with the assignment. Numbers 33. When you get, it lists all the stages there of Israel's journey, all the places they went, and during the 40 years of their wandering around. But cast your eyes down to verse 50 or so. On the plains of Moab, by the Jordan, across from Jericho, the Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into Canaan, drive out all the inhabitants of the land before you." Now note the word all. Drive out all the inhabitants of the land before you. Destroy all. Note the all. Destroy all their carved images and their cast idols, and demolish all, I need to say it again, all their high places. Take possession of the land and settle it, for I have given you the land to possess. Then distribute the land by lot. Now, by lot is by chance. Dice, it would be by lot. In first grade, they got the little sticks in there, and she pulls a stick out and reads Johnny's name, so you're not calling them the same kids all the time. It's a lot, by chance. By lot, distribute the land. To a larger group or a larger tribe, give a larger inheritance. To a smaller group, a smaller one. Whatever falls to them by lot will be theirs. Distribute it according to your ancestral tribes. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land, those you allow to remain will become barbs in your eyes and thorns in your sides. They will give you trouble in the land where you live, and then I will do to you what I plan to do to them. So they've got marching orders. They've got an assignment. They're meant to come in and conquer, to have a conquest of all of the known land of Canaan, from down where we have Kadesh Barnea, all the way up to Dan and beyond in the north. Now, when they come in tri. Well, I want to go back here. This is a better map. They come in what we call four campaigns. When Joshua leads the children of Israel in to conquer Canaan, they do it in four waves, four campaigns, four periods of time. In the first campaign, they come in and come straight across over the top right here and get to Jericho and a little country town called Ai. And there are two great stories that you know about in those two places. Then they have the central campaign where they're focused on the center section of Israel. When they finish that, they move to the south. When they finish that, they move to the north. So really three campaigns with kind of a start at the beginning with Jericho and Ai. Now, in your Bible, you can read the actual conquest of each of those places and see the name of the cities they take and the kings that are involved. But two stories that you got to make sure that you get in place in here. Well, actually more than two, but several stories. First, let me give you a time frame. It took about 6 years for them to do what they did do. They did not complete the job. Now, had they cleaned out all of the enemies of God at the time that God was empowering them to do so, the life of Israel would have been much different up to today. Up to today. But they didn't. They only wiped out some. They only conquered some. They only completed the job in some areas. Let's talk about that central campaign or that first real emphasis. They come up on the city of Jericho. What's the story of the city of Jericho? We got them on a hanger. Where does it go in our closet here, our biblical closet? What happened at Jericho? Walls came down, and the key word there is flat. The walls came down flat. The walls of a city at that time would have been wide enough for a chariot, two chariots, to run side by side on the top of the wall. So if the chariot was, I don't know, and I used to know the dimensions, but let's say for the sake of argument, it was 6 feet. If it was 6 feet for one chariot, it had to be 12 feet, so two chariots could run side by side on the top of the wall. So we're not talking a fence. You know, we're talking a wall. It fortified and protected that city, as was true of virtually all of the rest of the cities of that time period. So when they approached Jericho, their motley little crew, and here is this fortified city, God gave them an inspired military plan. What was it?
March around
one time a day for 6 days, and on the seventh day we've got a big finale. We're going to walk around seven times, and at the end of the seventh time, what are we going to do? Make a little noise. Now, if there was a military leader in the midst of Joshua and his buddies, what do you think he's doing when Joshua gives the battle plan?
Laughing
out loud. You gotta be kidding me. But in honor of God's leading, and we just read all the passages in Joshua 1 about his promise to be with him, Joshua, to his credit, says, okay, we've gotten our plan, we've gotten our marching orders, we're going to do it. We're going to look like twits, but we're going to do it. Okay, it's Halloween season. At our house, we never celebrated Halloween. We look like the twit of the neighborhood. Because on Halloween, we turn all the lights off and hide in the back bedroom with the door closed so nobody knows we're even home. And I don't hand out any candy. Do you think we're the hero of the neighborhood? No, we're not. And when Brianna was little, we used to find other times of the year to go bless all the kids in the neighborhood. Because I didn't want to be known as the one who hated candy or kids. I love candy and I love kids. But I didn't want to celebrate Halloween. So at that point, we look like twits. I'm guaranteeing you, them marching around the cities with a little casual conversation, once a day, about day four, the people inside Jericho are going crazy laughing at them. They're lined on the wall, three deep. Seventh day, they do exactly what God says, and the Bible's very specific, the walls fell down flat. Now, flat's a key component here because God wanted them to be able to walk in without a knockdown, drag out. Didn't want to kill them all off. So they conquered Jericho. Now, at the end of that battle, how do you think the military and the leaders of Israel are feeling? A little on the pumped up side. So they hit the next town and they are on top of things. the story of, well, before I leave Jericho, one more story to put on a hanger. The story of Rahab. What's the story of Rahab? When he sends the spies in at the early part, when they're trying to figure out how big of a town this is and are we going to be able to take them and how much military might do they really have, they send some spies in and they end up at a prostitute's house, a brothel, if you will. And when you read that, don't gloss over that. That is a house of prostitution with all of its uckiness that you can imagine. And so the spies get there and what happens? What does Rahab say? Takes him in, says, "Hey, I'd like to save my family. What can we do here? I tell you what, I'll hide you guys, and then when they come and they're looking for you, I'll have you tucked away. I believe it was up on our roof. And then when you guys come back, and I know you're coming back, don't wipe out me and my family." And what was the sign? Red rope. Red whatever. Yes, dear.
How could they promise that to her? God said to destroy everyone.
Don't know the answer to that. I can tell you why I think they did that, and that is there is a red line or a red cord or a red string or a red rope running from the first part of our Bible clear through to the last chapter of our Bible. And Rahab is a critical part of that story. The deliverance is coming via the red vine, the red rope, the red cord, the red ribbon, the red blood, the blood of Jesus Christ. And it's an enormously powerful early picture of God's provision for a few who would live by faith. Can you imagine her telling her children or her sister, "Okay, we're going to be fine." "No, we're not. They're coming." "No, we're going to be fine. I have this red cord. We're going to hang it out the window and everything's going to be good." That is about as ludicrous as Joshua saying to his military leaders, "We're going to walk around once a day for 6 days. God is interested in people believing him, taking them by his word, and providing salvation. So I have no better answer than that. So that's when the story of Rahab happens. What happens at Ai? No. They're a little overconfident. They are told to go in and wipe everything out. Wipe it out! What they do is one of them takes some goodies and hides them, a little profit on the side. And because of that, God lets a puny little town that was much less fortified than Jericho was wipe them out. And so Joshua and his buddies go, "What happened there?" "What happened is you didn't do it my way." God is not interested in partial obedience. In my life, I bargain with God. I will do this much, but I really don't want to do that part. And every time I start the wheeling and dealing, I end up with the short end of the stick. God's interested in all in. I'm not much into gambling, but I love the illustration. I'm all in. All the chips get poured across on the other side of the table. You know, don't put a few in your pocket for, you know, a rainy day. I'm all in. They weren't all in. And God got their attention. All right. There's also a battle in Joshua chapter 10 that happens during this time. Go to Joshua 10. As they're coming into the promised land and they're wiping out some of the southern states. So they've got the central campaign and the southern campaign and then the northern campaign. There's a huge battle going on over the Gibeonites, and Gibeon was a town. Let me see if I can find Gibeon on here. Here's Gibeon right here, just outside Ai. So they go to Ai, now they're coming to Gibeon. During that battle, things are not going well. Stuff is difficult. It doesn't look like they're going to win, and so God allows the sun to stand still. Do you remember the Sunday school lesson about the sun stood still? And here's where it happens, right in this campaign, after they leave Ai, they're going on to Gibeon, and God says, "You know what, you need a little more daylight here for this battle. In order for you to be victorious, you need a little more daylight, and I'm going to have the sun stand still. In essence, give you lots more daylight, the equivalent of perhaps a full day, maybe 10 hours or so, maybe 12, that allow you to go ahead and finish this battle, and you win. Now, even last night I was reading a commentary. We were talking about it before the lesson started. You know, commentators love to give you four or five possible answers as to what really happened there. One is that it's just a vocabulary issue. It's a literary device. It's just a way of saying God made it seem like there was lots more time so they could get the battle done. Are you guys freezing to death? Okay, make my friends happy, because I'll never be happy, so make them happy. On the other hand, bring blankets. It's a lot easier. You could explain away or make the literary application that he was just extending the day, because sometimes your day seems that it's longer. God gave you some extra time. He doesn't give you any extra time. It's still 24 hours in a day. Everybody's got the same amount of chronological time. But maybe there's a literary sense where he spread out his blessing and they seem to have more time to do their victory. Other commentators will say, well, maybe there was just a day when the sun was shining in a different way and it just seemed brighter, longer, and therefore they interpreted they got a longer day. And of course, there is another application, and that is he had the sun stand still in its orbit. Now, your teacher is a believer in the literalness of God's word. I'm going to approach every passage and attempt to take it at face value. There are some times when you're going to look at it and say, wait a minute, that's clearly alliteration. Clearly there's a literature thing going on here. Clearly that's a hyperbole. But if I can, I'm going to take every passage in a literal sense. So for me, this is the story of when God forced the sun and the moon to stop its journey across the cosmos and allowed him an extra, 12 hours with the sunlight in order to have a victory. But that's where that one hangs, is that sun stands still. Now, in your notes, you have got a fine and dandy chart, which begins to show you where they conquered the land, where the tribes went. Now, before we go into the distribution, I want you to just see, though, where they settled and where they didn't. The settlement or the conquest that they accomplished with the central campaign, the southern campaign, and the northern campaign is this brown part. Okay? The green part was not conquered. Now, a few minutes ago, I said that the fact that they did not complete the job impacts us up to today. A couple of little observations. Where's the Gaza Strip? We have any problem with the Gaza Strip today? Is it creating any difficulties for the Israelites? And I could go on. But my sarcasm would be dripping, so. But that's as far as they went.
The West Bank, too?
Well, I thought of that this morning, and I didn't look it up to see exactly where, the other, the Golan Heights and the West Bank are. That would be an interesting, you do that.
Okay.
You figure that out. But I just know that they didn't finish the job, and it's still impacting what they're doing today. Now, the land's got to be distributed. It's going to be distributed based on what we already read, according to their tribes. Now, look at this for a second. It's nice and color-coded. The one that's in your notes is not color-coded, although I like the one in your notes. You will notice it's the 12 tribes of Israel. Who are the 12 tribes of Israel? They are the sons of Jacob. Now, with two exceptions, who's not in here? Which of his 12 sons is not on this chart? Levi and Joseph. And in the place of Levi and in the place of Joseph, there are two other tribes. Who are they and why are they in here? Ephraim and Manasseh, and they are of Joshua, or of Joseph. Joseph's two sons, well, you're right, they're Jacob's grandsons, but Joseph's sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, take the place of Joseph and Levi. The Levites are not given land. The Levites are those who are to assist the priests with the work around the tabernacle and ultimately the temple. And I hope I have that in your notes, which I do on the next page. So great. The Levites do not get land. They get some cities. Ephraim and Manasseh, they get land. Joseph is no more. Now, who gets what? It was by lot. They pull the stick out. Okay, who's going to the north? Who's going to the south? Who gets the middle section? And it was on the basis of the size of the tribe. So by just glancing at that map, what was the largest tribe of Israel at that time? Manasseh. How much green is there?
Oh.
Lots of green. Right? Now, the distribution of the tribes is called, or the term for the tribes that are on that side of the River Jordan, it's called the Transjordan tribes. The Transjordan tribes are Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh. Manasseh got half on the Transjordan, on the eastern side of Jordan, and they got some on the western side. Reuben and Gad are Transjordan tribes. All the rest of them are on this side of the River Jordan. And they are allocated by lot, by size of the tribe. Now see Simeon down at the bottom? And one of the reasons I like this particular map that I put in your notes is you can see Simeon is completely encompassed by Judah. You see that?
Mm-hmm.
And over a period of time, Simeon just disappears. It just does. That's a great little bunny trail to chase down someday when you're trying to have fun figuring out something out of the Bible. That's a fun one. That took me one whole afternoon. But it does just disappear, and Judah becomes the whole southern tribe. And, of course, Judah is very large, as you can tell by the size. This map kind of cuts it off at the bottom. Jesus came from the tribe of
Judah.
Kind of important. What do we know about, for example, the tribe of Dan? What do you know about Dan? Not very big. Not very large. Size. If you were to go to the last three chapters of the book of Genesis, where Jacob's giving his blessing to his 12 sons, you can get some sense, some flavor of Dad's view of his sons. And therefore, the kind of flavoring of what that tribe was going to be like. Which ones were going to be warriors, which ones were going to be whiners, which ones were going to be whatever. And you can get a sense. But they're all distributed. You can see where they go. Now, the Levites don't get land. I said a minute ago they don't get lands, but they get cities. Let's go to, let me see. Numbers 35, probably. Let's go to Numbers 35. Yeah, that's a good one. Numbers 35, the first four or five verses. On the plains of Moab, by the Jordan, across from Jericho, the Lord said to Moses, command the Israelites to give the Levites towns to live in from the inheritance the Israelites will possess, and give them pasture lands around the towns. Then they will have the towns to live in and pasture lands for cattle they own and all their other animals. The pasture lands around the towns that you give to the Levites will extend 1,000 cubits from the town wall. Very specific dimensions. Outside the town, measure 2,000 cubits on the east side, 2,000 south, 2,000 west, 2,000 north, with the town in the center. They will give this area as pasture land for towns. The Levites were not given area, sections. The tribe of Manasseh here, for example, they spread out. This family went up here, this family went up here. Think of the Wild West when they would allow a certain land to be distributed. Everybody got in the wagons, cows took the wagons, whoa, run like mad, stake your flag down, this is my town, or not my town, my place to live. You know, they'd go by water first, the well-watered plains. You know, the poor guy that had the slow horse, he got there, he got the backside of the mountain with, you know, no water, and it was tough. That's the sense. They're all going out, taking over the section or area that's been allocated to them. It's allowing them to have physical land in which to raise their families, their agricultural in nature. And I can tell you just from my own trip, this section is much nicer for growing things than this section. So the guys on the east of Jordan, the Transjordan tribes, they had a tougher time from an agricultural sense than the tribes on this side. And maybe that's why Manasseh was split. It was so big it needed, you know, a lot of the families on this side. The Levites were not given land because their allegiance was not to be land-oriented. Their allegiance was to the temple or the tabernacle. Their allegiance was to their job. Their job is to work with and for the priests. Now, Aaron and his sons were the high priests, but the work around the temple, who carried this, who carried that, who lit this, who cleaned that, who made sure there was this many supplies and that this sacrifice happened this way, it was the Levites. They were service-oriented. They were not to get rooted into the land like the rest of the tribes. They were directly serving the Lord by serving in the tabernacle and later in the temple alongside the priests. For many years, I thought the Levites were the high priestly, that they were the same. That all the high priests were Levites and the Levites were all high priests and they were samey same. They're not. Aaron and the descendants from Aaron are of the priestly line. The Levites are the tribe that are assigned to help them. And down through the time period, they still need a place to live. God gives them the cities. And then he says, well, you got to be able to grow some veggies. And so he says, you know, 2,000 cubits out in every direction around your city, you can plant your little gardens. That's not the same as owning the land and becoming land-oriented. By the way, what's a cubit?
18. How do we know it's 18 inches?
Bet you my cubit's bigger than your cubit. A cubit is the distance between your elbow and the end of your finger.
Let me see.
If my cubit is bigger than your cubit. Ha ha, I got a bigger cubit. So if you're marking off things, you want to get somebody with a long arm. But that's a cubit. The measurement's between the elbow and the end of your finger.
So my cubit is bigger than your cubit.
All right. We okay on Levites? Now, next very exciting thing. It's my favorite part of... Oh, wait a minute. I got to tell you where the tabernacle was set up. The tabernacle was set up in Shiloh. Shiloh. Can I spot Shiloh real quick on this map? I have another map too. Let me see. Eh, that's not as good. It's kind of an interesting map. That gives you a different way of looking at it. Yeah, it's in the middle. Here it is. Here's Shiloh, right there. Good. Now, what happens in Shiloh?
God.
Well, there's one of those two, but for my purposes, in Joshua 18, there is the account that the tabernacle was set up there. Now, when they're wandering around the Sinai Peninsula for 40 years, they're hauling it with them. Remember, we're going to have a big lesson on this, but the walls are stakes in the sand, and then they put curtains around them, and they carried everything on poles, and wherever they went, the tabernacle went, and then they set it up, the Levites all set it up, put all the stuff in, the furniture went in the right places, and then when the either the fire at night or the light for the day would lead the cloud, would lead them, they'd pack it all up, and off they go. Well, now they're coming into the promised land. We need some element of permanence. It's still a tabernacle, not a permanent facility, per se. It's still tents of one kind or another, but it needs a permanent location, and it's taken to Shiloh, and it's left in Shiloh. Let's see, Joshua 18 is the passage that will help us with that one. Joshua 18. Don't get bored because we're coming to a really cool punchline. Joshua 18, verses 1 and 2. The whole assembly of the Israelites gathered at Shiloh, and they set up the tent of meeting there. The country was brought under their control, but there were still several Israelite tribes who had not yet received their inheritance. So during the time of their conquering Canaan, they take the tabernacle and set it up in Shiloh. Why do you think Shiloh? Just for the sake of some discussion.
Centered,
pretty centered. And where does the tabernacle end up? After Shiloh, where does it go? It goes to Jerusalem. There's a little side venture or two, but it's going to end up in Jerusalem. It's going to end up on the hill in Jerusalem. David's going to buy a threshing floor, and that's where they're going to set up the tabernacle. Where is that today? on the Temple Mount. On the Temple Mount. So, it goes to Shiloh at this point in their history.
What is the Temple Mount? I keep hearing that word.
If you take a picture, go look on your website, say, type in Temple Mount, it'll show you a picture of a raised area, and the Dome of the Rock is up on top of that raised area. That raised area was fortified, and that has come to be known as the Temple Mount, the mountain where the temple was. And its description and layout is a little different today than it was back then, but not that different. You can walk around it, you can see the gates, you can discuss the gates, you can see the stair steps coming out from the south where the pools were, where you bathed and washed yourself, where the animals were kept, the gates where women entered and where men entered. It is remarkable. You can see where in 70 AD when Titus and his crowd wiped it out, where the actual rocks that fell that Jesus said were going to get destroyed, you can walk up and sit on them. I sat on them. Wasn't supposed to, but I did. So it's an amazing, imposing place to this day. That's the Temple Mount. All right, so the tabernacle gets set up in Shiloh. All right, now we have a problem. Houston, we have a problem. Here's the problem. In all of their law giving and all of their understanding, one of the commandments was, thou shalt not murder. Remember? Mm-hmm. And I made a distinction with you that there was a difference between killing and murdering. So at this point in their history, they have a little discussion, and the discussion goes like this. So what happens when one of us accidentally murders someone? You know, we're out hunting, bow and arrow, spear, and, you know, the deer is here, and I sling it. I miss the deer, and I get my buddy, and he dies. There's a commandment, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, life for life. Am I going to get killed? Is there going to be justice exacted out of me because a death has occurred? Well, they don't have a structured government to have a judicial system to deal with that. So what are they going to do when someone, not out of anger, but out of accident, is murdered? How does the person who did it, with no evil intent, get their moment before some sort of judicial something? They sent them to a safe house. Excellent. Safe house. And the safe house are called cities of refuge. And that's another map. The cities of refuge essentially are those six circles. Now, the reason I like this chart is to prove this point. Each of these cities was chosen so that within a day's walk, you could get to it. So, roughly 20 miles. So, if you kill somebody with a bow and arrow out here, and it was accidental, and you don't want to be killed by all the tribal leaders, you can hot-foot it to Hebron. And as long as you got within the walls of Hebron, safe. And then there would be a judicial hearing. You could bring witnesses, the other side could bring witnesses, and a determination would be made. If you stopped outside the city walls, nanner, 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 they could kill you right there. You got to get in the city of refuge. Yes?
Isn't that when they made the temple, there was the horn, and if you grabbed the horn, that was pleading for...
That's a different issue, but yes, there is.
Oh,
the point of the cities of refuge, though, is... These cities were meant to provide comfort for those times in their lives when they have yet to have a government system that's set up to provide some sort of adjudication. And so the cities of refuge were set up. It's a very physical solution to a very physical problem. You got an issue where you're not guilty, but you need some time to be able to prove it, hot foot it to the safe house. And those six cities were set up as cities of refuge. Now, the thing that's so exciting to me, and where I said earlier today, we start with application, we end with application, these cities of refuge are pictures of Jesus Christ. They are an outstanding picture of a place to run and hide when we are guilty of sin. Go with me to the book of Hebrews, chapter 6. Hebrews, chapter 6. I love the cities of refuge. Hebrews 6. Start with verse 18. People swear by someone greater than themselves, and the oath confirms what is said and puts an end to all argument. Wait a minute, I don't like that one. This is 18. Yeah, I'm at 18. Okay, yeah, I backed up a little bit. Let's go to 18. God did this. No, let me start at 16. People swear by someone greater than themselves, and the oath confirms what is said and puts an end to all argument. Because God wanted to make the unchanging nature of his purpose very clear to the heirs of what was promised, he confirmed it with an oath. God did this so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, and we who have fled to take hold of the hope set before us may be greatly encouraged. We have this hope as an anchor for the soul, firm and secure. It enters the inner sanctuary behind the curtain where our forerunner, Jesus, has entered on our behalf. He has become our high priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. The idea is the hiding, the hope that is ours when we hide ourselves in Jesus. You know, the picture of the cities of refuge, it was meant to say to people, I know life is tough. I know it's difficult. I know not everything is under your control. And there are moments when you need to go somewhere and have a moment of hope. The moment of hope was get to a city of refuge. They will not be able to kill you on the spot. You will have a moment. And when we put our faith and trust in Jesus Christ, he is our hope. He is the place that we retreat to. He is the person to whom we retreat. He initiated the process. It's an expression of his grace. He provided all the means for it. He is the one who does the saving, and he keeps those in safety, those that are coming to him for salvation. I don't have to worry about my salvation anymore. Early on in my Christian life, I wondered whether or not I was saved. I went through that for about 3 or 4 months. And I've told you the story before about how I called my new pastor up at 7 in the morning on a Saturday morning and said, I got to see you right now because I'm not sure I'm saved. And he goes, okay. And I came down to the office and I sat in his office and he said, what do you mean you're not sure I'm saved? And I said, well, I went to a revival meeting this week and this guy preached on the rigors of hell and I'm not sure I'm saved. And he said, all right, do you know how to be saved? Well, yes, I do. And he said, well, explain it to me. So I gave him the whole gospel. And I'm turning my Bible and I'm giving him verses and I explained the whole thing to him. And he goes, okay, that's great. Is there anything that would keep you from being saved today? None whatsoever. You know what to do. Yes, I do. Well, let's do that. So I bowed my head and I prayed the most eloquent prayer you ever heard in your life about Jesus coming to my heart and being saved. I looked up and he said, well, in the authority of God's word, it says if you call, he will answer. Did you call? Yes, sir, I did. Did he answer? Yes, sir, I did. Are you saved? Yes, sir, I am. When did you get saved? 4 months ago. So what happened? Once I got through that little experience, I've not looked back with, I wonder if I'm saved. I don't fuss about that because I'm in the city of refuge. I'm tucked in. Nano. No can get me. I have tucked myself into the hope that is in Jesus Christ. And Satan and his crowd love to make you wonder, are you really saved? Are you really going to heaven? Are you really this? Did you see enough? Did you do enough? The guy that tucks in there, he's not saying or doing nothing. He's just hiding. I'm not saying or doing nothing. It's not on my performance. I'm tucked. I'm tucked in. And I'm not suggesting that we should do the nano thing, but from a spiritual standpoint, I don't worry about where I'm spending eternity. Because I've tucked into the city of refuge. Only it's the person of Jesus Christ. Do you not think that the Old Testament is filled with illustrations that make it possible for us to understand Jesus Christ? Which leads me to my discussion question for you in 1 Corinthians 10. So let me pray so you can talk about that. Lord, I am very grateful that today's lesson started with the encouragement that we are not to be fearful. That when you give us a job to do, whether it's raising 3 little boys that are driving us crazy or trying to hold together a family where the finances are so tight, bologna is even scarce, or whether it's dealing with the unknowns of car breaking down and leaking faucets, or it's health issues, or marriage strains and stresses, or family discord, Lord, that you promised And you ask us to be courageous, to trust in you, to do what you ask us to do, even when there are giants in the land. And so, Father, I thank you for that encouragement to start this lesson, and then the encouragement at the end, that if we tuck ourselves in the city of refuge, the person of Jesus Christ, we find ourselves safe and secure, and safe and secure forever. I'm grateful for that message today. In Jesus' name.